So I'd like to take you on a journey here throughout some part of complex fluids. And so basically we're going to be dealing with fluctuation-induced forces that govern the thickness of wetting layers. And the context of our problem is colloid polymer mixtures. And we'll see that the main thing about that system is that the scales are very different from the scales that we meet in molecular fluids. And that will give us extra opportunities, not only to visualize fluctuations, but also to study properties of fluctuations using some kind of what was considered highly academic theory for wetting in three dimensions with short-range forces. And I'd like to mention my collaborators, Yves Hennequin, Dirk Aerts, Henk Lekkerkerker, Daniel Bon. And first step in our journey is try to adjust everything to the size of the screen, which I'm not sure is working out. Does anybody have an idea how to improve on this? I think I can do it. I think it's...
If this is fit, then you have to change the resolution. So
if you choose slideshow, the top.
Slideshow?
Yeah.
Here? Thank you. So we'll go through several chapters of this story. We're going to have a look at the character of a colloidal suspension. And this is very, very introductory, actually. Then we're going to have a look at the interactions in our system, which will be, to a first approximation, just hard spheres. But then there will be attractions sort of added back on, because the original system also had attractions, but those were shuffled away in order to get pure hard spheres. And then attractions are very gently brought back into the story here. Then we're going to have a word about scales and contrast these colloid polymer mixtures with molecular fluids. Then we're going to deal with the main functions and variables of our problem. And then we concretize to a situation where we have semi-infinite system, strictly speaking, or more generally speaking, where we break translational invariance. So we introduce a wall, and we look at the wetting problem for this kind of colloid polymer system against the wall. And then we're going to have a close look at the free interface, which is a liquid-gas-like interface, far away from any sort of confining walls. And we're going to have a look at the capillary wave roughness that is characteristic of that interface. And then in the one but last part, we're going to go back to the system with confinement. And we're going to have a look at how the interface can unbind from a wall and how the subtle theoretical predictions for three-dimensional wetting with short-range forces can be tested here, and to what extent they can be tested. And finally, as a kind of bonus, we're going to have a look at the line tension of a three-phase contact line in this system and see how much we can say about that. Order of magnitude, sign of the quantity, if possible. These are a couple of papers that, on the one hand, give a lot of background on what is possible in this system. For example, how to measure surface tension, how to measure capillary lengths. And the last paper here, the second paper here, is about this line tension problem in particular. So let's go to colloidal suspension. So what do we have in mind here? In fact, we're going to go back in time, and we're going to pay tribute to three almost unknown persons. And they are Belgian Jesuits. And at around 1874, they came up with some statements and published them that were dealing with interpretation of Brownian motion. And they realized that Brownian motion is a dance driven by the collisions of the particle with atoms in the surrounding fluid, according to the kinetic theory of heat. And this was a rather early time to make that such sort of statements, because only somewhat later, the precision experiments of Perrin in Paris and the highly sophisticated theory of Einstein in respectively 1910 and 1905 gave a lot more detail on what actually that Brownian motion is doing and how the particle excursions come about because of these collisions with the presumed atoms that are there in the fluid. And only since about 1910, almost every scientist was convinced of the existence of atoms. And in fact, not earlier than that, because up till then, there had been no such precise evidence. And up till then, the concept of atoms and molecules was more a model, was more a hypothesis than proven reality. Now, what makes a suspension stable? Why don't bricks sort of fly all over the place suspended in air? And that we can track down to a criterion which we could call levitation by agitation. So if there's sufficient agitation, then things can actually come off and go all about in space and keep jiggling around. And what you can do is you can use the Piquelin number. And the Piquelin number is basically has to do with, if you like, a ratio of velocities or a ratio of times, or in this case, a ratio of energies. And it all boils down to the same thing. So you check the product of the buoyant mass of the particle times the gravitational acceleration times the typical size of the particle. And that's an energy which is a potential energy, clearly, of an object, for example, going down by its own distance in the gravitational field. And you can say that fall converts, say, potential to kinetic energy. You can check the speed that the particle acquires. But if that speed is substantially less than the speed that is derived from kT, then the thermal jiggling overpowers this sedimentation attempt. And then the suspension will be stable. And so for typical colloidal particles of a micron size, this number is about 1. And for a tenth of a micron size, floating is highly enhanced by a factor of 10 to the 4, because there is radius to the power 3 in this buoyant mass here, and there's another radius here. So this gives us an idea of criterion for stability of a suspension, which is rather handy. And so the colloidal particles we'll be dealing with in this story are actually about a tenth of a micron large, or a hundredth of a micron large. Now we're going to say something about the interactions. So in various laboratories to date, and in particular in the laboratory of Henk Lekkerkerker in Utrecht, scientists succeeded in manipulating interactions between particles in a rather sophisticated manner. And for example, what is being done here is that colloidal particles, for example, PMMA particles, are coated by, firstly, an adsorbing polymer in order for the particles to bounce off each other more or less like billiard balls. And so they are, to a good approximation, hard spheres. In addition to this coating with adsorbing polymers, which is done prior to introducing the polymers that you see in this picture, those are different polymers, Those are actually responsible for the attractions that we reintroduce. But prior to that, the coated colloidal particles not only bounce off each other like hard spheres, but also the omnipresent van der Waals interactions are almost eliminated by matching the colloids against the solvent in terms of two properties, in terms of firstly the static dielectric constant, and that will, if you do that matching, that will almost kill the static part of the Hamaker constant, which is kT times product of differences of static dielectric constants of colloid minus solvent times solvent minus colloid, if you like. Or in general, dielectric constant of phase 1 minus phase 2 times that of phase 2 minus phase 3 if you have particles 1 and 3 in solvent 2. And then a second matching is done, that is the matching of the refractive indices in the optical. And that will kill the retarded part of the van der Waals interactions. That will kill the retarded part of the Hamaker constants, which is proportional to h bar times a particular excitation frequency, the main excitation frequency of the atoms concerned. And so this refractive index matching and static dielectric constant matching is of course not perfect, but the result of the, say, rather fine-tuning of these properties between colloid and solvent reduces the Hamaker constant by about a factor of 100 compared to what it otherwise would be. And so one can safely say that these particles behave like hard spheres. And so then the problem is, well, hard spheres do have a phase transition. They do have a crystal fluid phase transition. But this is not actually what we're after here. We're after a liquid gas-like transition here. And that can be achieved now in the following way. So we're after liquid gas transition with a critical point as for the, say, the easing model. As for, say, ordinary fluids or binary mixtures of such objects. And what we're going to do is, starting from the hard-sphere interaction, we're going to introduce objects here in the solvent which will generate an attractive tail between the colloid particles. And the objects that we introduce are non-adsorbing polymers with a radius of gyration that is comparable to the colloidal particle radius. And if we do that, then we get this so-called depletion attraction or entropic interaction between colloidal particles. Imagine that these polymers are, to first approximation again, just spherical balls. And imagine that you bring colloidal particles closer to one another than the typical size of this polymer. Then the polymer will be excluded from going into this volume that is actually a volume that is an overlap of excluded zones that we see here. And the polymer cannot go into the excluded zones with its center of mass. And this means that here we cannot have polymers in between these two colloidal particles anymore. And at that point, we suddenly start losing entropy. So there are much less configurations for the polymers to go into. And then it's more favorable free energetically to just squeeze the colloidal particles all together in order to lower the overall free energy again, to raise the entropy again. Or another way to try to understand this attraction, this depletion attraction, is to say that if you empty this space of polymer here, because it just won't allow the polymer to get into it anymore, then you can say that there's an osmotic pressure acting through a virtual semi-permeable membrane. So there are no longer polymers allowed in this zone here. They're sort of excluded. But the excess pressure, the pressure that's exerted by considering the polymers as an ideal gas, which slightly perturbs the solvent, this osmotic pressure is then acting, say, in principle, isotropically everywhere, but since there are no polymer in here, it's trying to push these colloids actually together, because there's no counterpressure here from this zone. And so that's this depletion attraction, that's this force that's acting, which has nothing to do with energetic considerations, really, because there's no bond zero of any kind, but there's just entropy considerations. So this is something, an interaction that's going to be straight proportional to KT, and the number of polymers that are excluded from this particular volume here. So that's going to be the interaction potential. And that's written down here, where you see that the interaction potential is minus the osmotic pressure, which in an ideal gas approximation, that's actually the density of polymers times the overlap volume. And, this is the density of polymers times KT, because of Van't Hoff's ideal gas approximation for that dilute polymer system, times the overlap volume here to give you the pressure times volume to give you the energy of the interaction. And that's drawn here. And it's very important to realize there are actually two parameters. One is the typical range of this attraction. The other is the typical strength of the interaction. Now, clearly, the strength of the interaction is going to be proportional to the density of polymers that you put in. So you can tune the strength of the interaction by adding polymer.
A question here.
Yes.
If you're not in the Van't Hoff limit, that really wouldn't change anything, right? You just take the corresponding osmotic pressure, and the potential is given by the same formula.
Yes. It's only when you want to put here density times KT straight away.
That of course can be different for.
Yes.
Is different for higher density.
I would think that's correct. Yeah.
Not so fast. If you have a very high polymer concentration, then that dip line is going to begin to reflect the blob size, not the whole areas of generation of molecules. You'll have a change. You're not doing that experiment.
But the osmotic pressure will still be whatever.
Absolutely.
It is. In
absolutely. The accessible volume will change the nature of the no?
I think what I understand from your comment is that the overlap volume calculation will be affected as well.
Yeah.
But it will still be called the overlap volume. And so this is almost like a thermodynamic thing if you write it like this. And that's what you're saying.
But you know, there are these funny effects when you get a higher polymer and then it drives the particles apart. So it could happen that when the polymer is so concentrated it can get in there, then it actually enjoys the new space. That's nothing near the regime you're working in, but it's a little bit tricky. And Rudy's question is how much do you treat it as Van't Hoff? Van't Hoff itself goes with some idea about what volume fills or the fraction of the volume occupies.
How fast they decay is attraction? How fast they go to decay?
This is a strictly finite interaction.
Just finite?
Yes.
It's a power law.
Yes, and just powers of R. Just overlap volumes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's strictly finite ranged. So as soon as you take them farther away than this, than the excluded zones, the whole effect is gone. Yeah.
So
and this is.
These measurements are done at that limit.
I don't think they worry about that in the experiments, but in order to try to get a grip on the theoretical understanding of this thing, you start there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But in the experiments, they go all the way to the crystal phase and everything. And
they still assume a Van't Hoff pressure?
I don't think so, no. They don't assume don't assume that to to find their way in the experimental arena. They just do the experiment.
Your audience in there, the size of the body in there is less than the size of the bullet, right?
You're in a regime where the size of the polymer is comparable to and not much larger than the size of the colloid. Comparable to means, you know, could be half that.
Does it overlap?
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly would break down if we imagine that the polymer is also a sphere of the same size as your colloid. Then it's really the same thing.
Yes, yes, that's right. So let me comment on this right away. So the whole idea of this system is that we're not in the world of mixtures of hard spheres of different sizes. We're very far from that because of the penetrability properties of the polymers. So we are very much closer to the concept of penetrable hard spheres from the point of view of the polymer system. And it's just the fact the polymers cannot enter the colloid.
And they're saying that in theoretical calculations, you have to start learning if you're coming to the limit where the treatment seems to be spheres of the same size.
Absolutely. And also, even if they're not of the same size, but if they're impenetrable, then we will have oscillations in this interaction. Whereas here it's strictly monotonically decaying and strictly finite range.
Also, I guess you have to assume that there's no specific interaction between the polymer and the hard sphere, because otherwise you could have things like bridging interaction and so on.
Yes.
So you have a completely different effective potential.
Yes, and what is done here is we start from this penetrable hard sphere model. But in reality, depending on the solvent, depending on whether it's a good solvent and so on for the polymers, we enter situations where polymers can sort of start wrapping around to colloids, and where this excluded zone is then drastically reduced. So that's a complication which is dealt with when excluded volume interactions are taken into account, and I will comment briefly on that. So I think to summarize these various comments, I think it's very important to realize that to a first approximation, this system consists of polymer particles that do not see each other and that just are blocked out by the colloidal particles. Okay, then if we tune the system so that the depth of the interaction potential is proportional or is of the same order of magnitude as KT, then we have a system in which we can have, in an easy manner, gas-liquid equilibria. Because you know from simple lattice gas considerations and from sort of Lennard-Jones considerations that typical values for epsilon over KT for triple points and critical points are of order 1. And so this is being exploited here, together with the fact that the range of this attraction should be more or less of the same order as the colloidal diameter. So the conspiration of these two properties makes possible phase separation into a liquid-like phase, which is dense in colloidal particles, relatively poor in polymer, and the converse phase, separated by an interface, which is, to very good approximation, an easing model interface, because the pair potential for the particles that you effectively netto keep in your description, which are the colloids with a kind of mediated interaction, is of strictly finite range. And so that's good for easing and Lenz and whoever thought of these kinds of systems in that simple way.
Yeah. So run this by me again. You manipulate the attraction, the attractive magnitude by density?
That's right, polymer density.
And what is phi p?
Phi p is the, is the polymer volume fraction. So that's density of polymer times 4/3 pi radius of gyration cube.
And the range of the interaction?
And the range depends exactly on this radius of gyration. So sigma p is the diameter, is twice the radius of gyration. That's an approximation. I can tell you a little bit about that because I should at some point do that. And this extra bit of, say, radial distance here that defines the excluded zone is only equal to the radius of gyration in the description of ideal polymers in bulk. And even if you consider the slight modification of putting ideal polymers near a wall, then already that depletion length is going to differ from the radius of gyration. And this has been studied by, for example, Eisenriegler and others. And people have also studied this depletion length in the context of these objects here, which are curved. And also in that case, you have corrections that express the depletion length in quantities which are ratios of radius of gyration to radius of the colloidal particle. So the curvature comes in explicitly. But to a very first approximation, think of the depleted zone radius here, or the increment of this radius, so the depleted zone length, as the radius of gyration of the polymer. This depletion attraction is attributed to two groups of scientists, so to speak, Asakura Osawa in the 1950s and then Achinus Frey in the 1970s. So number three on our list is the scales in this problem. So what makes this problem particular? What's the difference with respect to molecular fluids? So the first thing we're going to look at is the interfacial tension. Now, the interfacial tension can be estimated by taking into account that you have, say, a phase dense in colloidal particles and a phase which is very dilute in colloidal particles. And so the colloid-colloid interaction bond, so to speak, is broken in a direction perpendicular to the interface. And this broken bond, which is of order epsilon in energy, is counted once per colloidal area squared. So a rough estimate of the interfacial tension is epsilon over sigma squared, where sigma is the colloidal diameter. Now, this estimate, of course, formally holds in molecular fluids as well, but there sigma is the atomic or molecular diameter. So you can see here that because of this sigma squared, you have a typical ratio of about a million relative to molecular fluids, taking into account that epsilon is of order kT in order to make this story work in both systems. So you get ultra-low interfacial tension here. You go into the nanonewton per meter regime, or tens, or maybe 100 nanonewton per meter, instead of the millinewton per meter regime for molecular fluids. That's a very important first consideration, and has the immediate effect that the typical thermal agitation of the interface is much more pronounced in this system, because that thermal agitation of the interface is governed by, on the one hand, temperature that wants the interface to fluctuate, and surface tension that wants to moderate this fluctuation. And so this ratio of kT to gamma to the square root is a length and is an amplitude of the sort of capillary wave fluctuations, the basic amplitude of those fluctuations. And if you take into account that what we said about interfacial tension and the fact that epsilon is of order kT in this realization of the system, you come to a thermal length which is of the order of the particle diameter. So you're in the micron or tenths of micron range for that thermal agitation length, which is much, much larger than the typical nanometer or tenth of a nanometer range for molecular fluids. So you're going to be able to see the thermal fluctuation of that interface using optical microscopy. Because you're going to enter into the wavelength regime of visible light, which is the order of micron. So that's for the thermal agitation length. And then there is the question of the capillary length. And so the capillary length is a measure of competition between surface tension, that if the interface starts out from a wall here, a vertical wall, there is a thermodynamic contact angle. And the interface would very much like to respect that angle and to keep respecting it also going away from the wall if it were only for surface tension, because surface tension tries to minimize area. But then there is gravity, and gravity will say the interface eventually has to go horizontal. And so this competition is reflected in this length, which is again a crossover length, which tells you how far away from the wall you have to go in order to begin obeying the bulk field, so to speak, or say gravity. And this ratio is determined by the surface tension over gravitational acceleration times density difference between liquid and gas phases. And how about this order of magnitude of this quantity? We already know that the interfacial tension is very, very low, by a factor of a million lower than what is usual in molecular fluids. Gravitational acceleration is not doing anything here. Delta rho is also not doing much, because although the gas phase here is not light, it's rather heavy, but it could be like maybe the density of it could be like maybe 2/3 of the density of the liquids. So they're both actually liquids in normal ways of speaking. But if you look at the density difference, that will still be of the same order as the density of the liquid itself, right? Because 1/3 of something is still of more or less the order of that something. So nothing so much is changing here with respect to molecular fluids, where this would be liquid and gas density difference, which would be just the density of the liquid, basically. Then taking the square root will actually, say, in terms of the exponents, cut the ultra-low surface tension effect by a factor of 2. And so what you get is that your capillary length is reduced by about a factor of 1,000 with respect to what it is in molecular fluids. And that's very interesting, because to the eye, it will look like the contact angle is somewhere about 90 degrees. Whereas in a cup of tea, you can see that meniscus very well bent already over scale of millimeters in ordinary fluids. And here you're in the micron or tens of micron range for the capillary length, which is quite small. So those are typical scales that we have to keep in mind.
So, I'm missing a little piece here. So the idea is that particles are roughly triangular to the glass.
Okay, so this is...
It's going to tell you a little bit about how it has to get stirred.
Yeah.
It forgets the glass, the same characteristic.
Well, I'll come to that in a moment, but I'll start talking about it right now. So what is the attraction? What is actually the force, or what is the preference, so to speak? What preference does a wall have for either the liquid or the gas in this system? So what preference does a wall have for a phase that's dense in colloids or that's dilute in colloids? And the only interaction, as we know, if we can ignore all sorts of dielectric effects, which to some approximation is okay, is that the only interaction here, or say the basic interaction here, the dominant one, is this entropic interaction. So it's overlap of excluded zones. And the overlap of excluded zones is very important if you take into account the excluded zone of the wall and the excluded zone of a particle. The overlap will be larger for a given separation, will be larger than the overlap of excluded zones between two colloidal particles mutually. And this means that the wall prefers the colloidal, the dense colloidal phase. So this means a contact angle will, in some convention, say, will be between 0 and 90 degrees.
be able to make delta rho very small, changing the material of the coloring is really critical. Very negative.
That should definitely be possible, but it's not done right here in this in these examples. In these examples, delta rho is of the same order as the density of an ordinary liquid.
Have you taken one of these wires in hand and shake it? What's the dynamics like?
Myself? I don't remember if I've done that. Yeah, I can tell you about the dynamics of this these interfacial fluctuations rather than the dynamics of shaking the sample and seeing whether there's anything viscoelastic or anything like that going on. But for these capillary waves, we will see that the timescales, which are governed by the viscosity and the capillary length, and there is another parameter there that I'd like to bring in. It's just surface tension, actually. So basically, you have viscosity over surface tension times capillary length. We're going to come to that in a little more detail, but I can already tell you it gives you timescales of the order of seconds or tens of seconds compared to 10 to the minus 5 seconds in molecular fluids. So not only the spatial extent of the fluctuations is amenable to direct visual inspection using optical microscopy, but also the timescales are very favorable in order for you to see relaxation of capillary waves on a length scale of seconds. So, and that's a very interesting advantage as well. Now, the main functions and variables here can be distilled to a first approximation as follows. So what is rather interesting to do here is to consider your system as a system of hard spheres plus perturbatively added attractions. And the system of hard spheres is a system consisting of n colloidal particles in a volume V at temperature T. And what is then done is to consider the non-adsorbing polymers as coming in from a reservoir through a semi-permeable membrane, which they can penetrate, which the colloidal particles cannot, and to fill up this system up to a particular density of polymers by tuning the chemical potential of polymer in the reservoir, and to bring that up from, say, minus infinity to the actual chemical potential value of polymer in the reservoir. And the free energy contribution of that is basically an integral which is like a minus mu times n contribution. And this is integrating the chemical potential of the polymer reservoir from a particular value, which is minus infinity when there are no polymers in, to the actual value that we have. And the integrand is the number of polymers that are in the system, that are in the volume V, given a particular value of the polymer chemical potential in the reservoir. So this is the basic formula, which is the correction term that is added here to the hard sphere free energy expression. And for the case of ideal polymers, you can figure out that this expression gives you via the Gibbs-Duhem relation, just kT times the number of polymers. So you have a contribution of kT per polymer particle to the semi-grand canonical potential that is governing this system here in this volume V. So I've written down this expression here just to illustrate that this is the most simple form that you can find for this combined free energy. I've also written down the Van't Hoff relation for the ideal polymers, which is osmotic pressure is the product of density of polymer in the reservoir times kT. Also, in order to have the most simple expressions there to just get a picture of what is going on, and all the other steps are complications on top of this picture. Now, if we want to understand in these simple terms what are the basic variables of this problem, we can just start from there and ask ourselves, what is the number of polymers in this volume V? And we can just write that down as the density of polymers in the reservoir times the available volume for polymers in this volume V, and that's the actual volume minus the non-available volume. And so this available volume, or free volume as it is called, defines or is the basic ingredient in an approach which is called free volume theory for this system. And it's a fraction alpha times the volume, and so it's the volume minus something that is forbidden. And the forbidden zones are, roughly speaking, determined by the volumes of, in this approximation, presumably distant colloidal particles one from another. So there are no overlap effects included here in this very simple estimate. And you see that you have just the volume of a sphere here, which has radius of a colloidal radius plus this depletion length, which for ideal polymers in bulk is the radius of gyration. So this gives you an intuitive first picture of what is this free volume. Now, in a more elaborate description, the fraction alpha depends not only on the colloidal volume fraction corrected in a simple way with the radius of gyration, but is a more complicated function of the colloidal volume fraction, which is the volume occupied by the colloidal particles without their excluded zones divided by the total volume. So that's this volume fraction phi c. But the fraction alpha is also a function of the ratio of the depletion length to the colloidal radius. And those expressions are rather involved, and they come from something called scaled particle theory. And I'm not giving you any details here of that. But note that already in this very simple approximation where the depletion length is the radius of gyration, you see clearly that alpha is less than 1 minus the colloidal volume fraction, because that would only take into account RC and not the delta here. And to a first approximation, again, you can say that alpha is about 1 minus phi c. So it gives you an idea of alpha. Now, the polymer volume fraction, which is the number of polymers divided by the volume, so which is the density of polymers times the volume of a polymer assuming the radius of gyration as its radius divided by the total volume, is this fraction alpha times the polymer volume fraction in the reservoir. So this means that the volume fraction of the polymer in the actual volume V is less than that in the reservoir, for obvious reasons, because they're excluded volumes. And this factor alpha plays there as well. So what we see now here at the end of this very simple chain of arguments is that there are, in fact, two densities that are important. So there is the colloidal volume fraction and the polymer volume fraction. And the polymer volume fraction is basically slaved, if you like, to the polymer volume fraction in the reservoir, which you can consider as a control parameter, directly controlled by the chemical potential of the polymers in the reservoir, times this alpha, which itself is a function of the colloidal volume fraction. So you see that There is a control parameter here, which is the reservoir concentration of polymers, essentially. And that control parameter will control the actual polymer volume fraction through the colloidal volume fraction. And if you make systems now, if you make your mixtures according to a recipe which is called the dilution recipe, so you have different realizations of your system in which you systematically dilute everything in the same proportion, and you're then moving on a dilution line which will go through the origin, which is about here, and preparing such systems, you can approach the phase boundary where phase separation ceases to exist, and you can try to approach it in such a way that you're hitting the critical point, which is a challenge in itself. So there are tie lines in this phase diagram which roughly run like this, which are inclined in this picture. And so a system like this will phase separate into composition which is here and a composition which is here. The picture that's in the inset gives you two quantities related to the interface, to the free interface. The quantity here in blue is the interfacial tension. Excuse me, that's wrong. The quantity in blue is the thermal width of the interface. So it's the kT over gamma square root thing, which, as you see, will be rather large for systems which have a very low interfacial tension. So the red line here is the interfacial tension of the free interface. And you can see the correspondence between the width and the interfacial tension. So the lower the interfacial tension, the wilder the thermal fluctuation of the interface can be.
How are they measured?
Okay. So the techniques that they use allow them to measure the height-height correlation functions in the interface as a function of space and time. And from those, from the amplitude of those, you get the kT over gamma. And from the space dependence of the spatial correlation function, you get the capillary length. And from the time dependence of the time correlation function, you get the capillary time.
So they don't measure surface tension, do they?
They do sometimes. They do sometimes using spinning drop method, for example. Which is a complementary technique.
But I think the width is just looking at the picture of the interface and trying to do kind of coarse grain and then.
That's right. That's right. It's an analysis on visually obtained pictures. Absolutely. So a little bit more about that here in a moment. So we come to let's say the final part, which deals with the wetting problem itself. So here we have the Young-Laplace equation, which will give you the thermodynamic contact angle in terms of the surface free energies of respectively the wall gas interface, the wall liquid interface, and the liquid gas interface. And in order to get a rough idea of what these quantities are and to get a picture of whether or not wetting phase transitions are possible in this system, that is to say whether or not one can find parameter values, one can find, for example, values of polymer concentration for which the contact angle will actually become zero and stay zero in a different regime, which is called a complete wetting regime. So in order to study the possibility of wetting phase transitions where this cosine of theta would tend to one and stay one, so that there's a singularity in this part of the surface free energy, One can use what is called the mean field approach, a Kahn-Landau theory, which uses on top of free energy density, which is roughly our semi-grand canonical potential divided by the volume of the system. It's written here in a slightly different way via Helmholtz free energy. But basically, these first three terms are double well potential, which expresses the free energy per unit volume of these coexisting phases. And then the gradient term here counts free energy penalty for inhomogeneous states, for states with a profile in density. Now, what is the density here in this description? That's the first important point to make. The density in this system, in this description, is the colloidal volume fraction. Now, strictly speaking, one would have to work with two densities here, because there is the colloidal and there is the polymer volume fraction. But we've seen before that to a first approximation, the polymer volume fraction is dictated by the external control parameter, which will tune us to two-phase coexistence and so on, and the colloid volume fraction. So we can get away with a theory that deals with one order parameter here in a first shot. And that's why this is done in this way. There are boundary terms here that express the preference of the wall for either the liquid or the gas phase. And this is described by a surface field. And now I come back to the remark I made before, that the surface prefers the colloid-rich phase. And this will determine the sign of H1. And this will make so that, for example, H1 in this case is positive, which means that higher colloid fractions are favored near the wall. Yes, so there, to a first approximation again, we assume that that van der Waals effects are small. And this would require also some delicate dielectric constant matching, which may by far may not be perfect here. But if you start from there, then it's again the excluded zone near the wall and the excluded zone around the colloidal particle that will overlap. And that will overlap will prevent polymers from coming in there. And so that will introduce an attraction, a depletion attraction between the colloidal particle and the wall, in very much the same way as it is between two colloidal particles. But the geometrical effect is stronger here. The overlap is bigger for a given separation. And therefore, there is a net attraction between the colloid rich phase and the wall, which is a finite range, strictly finite range again, and can therefore be rather well represented by a contact interaction. Yeah, that was actually the point you were heading on. Okay. The second term here reflects that the colloid-colloid attraction is modified near a wall relative to what it is in the bulk of the system. And that is because you have triple overlap volume. You have overlap volume between two colloidal particles, which has a part that's already covered by the excluded zone of the wall. And so the net attraction between colloidal particles that are close to a wall is reduced with what it is for particles away from the wall. And the reduction of the pair interaction close to a wall is described by this enhancement, which is a dehancement in practice in this case. And that will influence the wetting phase transition in the sense that manipulating that particular object there can give rise to transitions which are leading you from a regime of first order wetting transitions to a regime of critical wetting transitions. So we can play with that.
So who is being excluded for which reason? There's the polymer that doesn't go between the spheres. There's a polymer that doesn't go near the glass. And you're suggesting there's a kind of a different reach in these cases, or they're both doing the same work at the same time. I'm having a little trouble knowing what dominates here. I was thinking much more simply in terms of either the polymer or either a glass and particle, or the polymer or particle and polymer.
I have a very simple picture in mind here, yeah. And it is if you look at the excluded zones, let's have a look at them. If you look at the overlap volume, okay, and suppose that this overlap volume overlaps itself with the excluded zone that's due to a wall, then the overlap volume between these two particles, actually as a function of their distance, is a smaller quantity.
Little area, and that actually is significant.
Yeah.
So like three guys are
that's
excluding,
right.
But who cares? Because one is enough.
Yeah.
And then that does or doesn't get into the question of polymer size in a different way.
It doesn't matter if you associate polymers, if you give polymers a specific size.
Okay,
but if you're asking me whether in the excluded volume interaction theory, there will be different ways that the polymer can curl around or stretch near a wall, and so then certainly there will be differences and complications. And how much that would change the picture, I'm not sure about. So here we see that this Kahn-Landau theory can be used in its most simple form with one order parameter, with basically a surface field and an enhancement. And people have been working with that sort of theory all over the place. And so once you have defined the different quantities, for example, I just was talking about rho and identifying it with the colloid volume fraction. Now, how about this parameter m? This parameter m is related to the second moment of the direct correlation function. And the direct correlation function itself is basically beta or minus beta times the interaction potential at short distances and zero at larger distances. And so there is a direct connection between this parameter m and this interaction, which is the density of polymers times kT times the overlap volume. And so all of the quantities here in this Kahn-Landau theory can be identified in terms of the material characteristics of the colloid polymer system. And the result of working with this theory is that first-order wetting transition is predicted depending on the ratio of radius of gyration to colloidal particle radius, it can be further or closer to the critical point of the system. Now, this is, of course, to be taken with a bucket of salt because this is a very simple description. And already comparing it to experiments, one finds that although there have been reports of wetting phase transition in these systems by Cohen-Stewart and colleagues, the group of Lekkerkerk and Arts and colleagues rather claim that they see complete wetting and only complete wetting in their systems. And these two experimental groups have had their debates about whether or not there is actually a wetting phase transition in the Cohen-Stewart and collaborators system. So that's probably not yet completely settled. But the results I'm going to talk about are consistent with a complete wetting, that is to say, contact angle zero, and a situation where the wetting layer is merging with the bulk liquid here in a way which is compatible with zero contact angle. Now, it's very tough to prove that the contact angle is actually zero. So also, this has to be taken with at least a spoon of salt. Now, the properties I want to focus on, in fact, are not actually properties that go on here in this corner where the three phases meet. Three phases being the gas-like, liquid-like, and wall. Although at the very end, in part 8, I will comment on the three-phase contact line properties. But for the time being now, I'm going to concentrate on the properties a bit away from that contact zone and properties of the wetting layer itself and of the interface that separates that wetting layer from the gas-like phase. And with this technique of confocal scanning microscopy, one has measured the intensity, fluorescence intensity of the colloidal particles that are actually given fluorescent properties in this experiment. And this intensity as a function of distance from the wall is plotted here. And so as you go away from the wall, in this case a horizontal direction, through the vertical wetting layer, you see an intensity profile like this, and if you take the derivative of that, you can identify these two different interfaces, which is first of all the wall wetting layer interface, and that's rather sharp, so the apparent width of that gives you an idea of the instrumental resolution. And then the second interface that you see here is the wetting layer crossing over to the gas phase. And there is an apparent width here, which is, if you square it, if you take the variance, is the sum to a first approximation of the instrumental variance and the actual real width squared. So that's a convolution approximation that will describe how rough the interface is which bounds the wetting layer against the gas phase. And that's a quantity of major interest here, because we're going to try to relate that width of that interface to the thickness of the wetting layer itself, which is the distance basically from here to here. So we're going to try to understand a bit more about the relationship of this width relative to the wetting layer thickness. Having in mind that for rough interfaces, this width will eventually diverge for interfaces that unbind from a wall. So if we take a sample of the system like this, and we look at it like that, then we see this picture here. So we're looking along the dotted line,
yes,
and we're looking perpendicular to my hand, okay? And then we're seeing that picture here. And then as we go, this is as we are more or less at the interface between wetting layer and gas phase, and this is what we see when we're a bit further into the system at about this location here. Then we see the gas-liquid interface, and on top here we see the gas phase.
Does gravity play any effects here? Does it matter how?
Well, it definitely matters here. And here it actually also matters. So there is a profile of thickness as a function of height. And that's one of the things we attempted to calculate. And that's one of the things that was measured as well. And I'm not sure I have a picture of that here in the slideshow.
So this would be like,
but
it's called Anderson-Sabisky experiment?
Yes. Yes, for complete wetting, yes,
but,
in fact.
But only up until it goes constant. What you want us now to constant.
It's in the figures
on
that
part. Where that green band is essentially its width doesn't change that much.
No, it doesn't change much.
Yeah, so that the Anderson-Sibirsky thing was the torque valve part of the bottom.
Yes, and there the context was van der Waals interactions and retarded and non-retarded, and a crossover was seen.
So the red one is the derivative of the density of the green stuff.
The red line is the derivative of this here.
Right. Well, terms, green stuff. Yeah. So, as you go across left to right.
Yes.
And the particle sizes on this scale,
so the particles are about a tenth of a micron.
Oh, okay, so it is extended over a mile. Could you say twice whether this is instrument limited or particle limited?
Instrumental resolution?
Yes, so
yes.
Is the thickness of that distribution dominated by the just the microscope, or is it better than?
So
I just want to get clear. You said it a couple of times because you were being very careful.
So the thing is that the apparent width, let's call it sigma apparent squared, is the instrumental resolution width squared plus the actual width that we're interested in.
Exactly. So
in this convolution approximation.
Right. So what do you want us to think about the difference between the two terms on the right?
So, okay, so this is the quantity we will try to extract. Okay? And this is a quantity which we see reflected in this bump here, okay.
Why should I interpret that as instrumental? Because if I look at your theory and follow the profile, because of your electron, there will be higher density at the wall itself, right? So there is some, just because of the formula that you have written, some variation in intensity or density as you go across.
Yes.
Goes to the
That's correct. That's correct.
So that variations that you see there has no reason to be just instrumental.
Yes. I think the idea is the following, that here, say, the decay of the signal into the wall, so to speak, has a sharpness which, ideally speaking, should be of distance, should be the molecular distance. Because
your H1 is acting at the wall and changes the density, and you have a correlation that is set by your M of rho. There is a variation that starts at the wall and is going to extend with the order of the correlation.
Yes, but into the wall, you expect a sharp drop.
Oh, but.
And it has a tail.
How do you determine where is the wall?
Well, that's exactly what's the issue here. So you can say we know exactly where the wall is up to an error, which is of the order of the width of this signal here. Because if the wall were actually, if the technique would allow you to see that the colloidal density drops over molecular distances at the wall, which it actually does, then this part of the profile here, of the intensity profile, would be much sharper. And so this decay here reflects that there is an uncertainty on the position of the wall.
Sure, you could come to something like look at different colored light or something that the glass responds to and determine the end of the wall much more sharply.
That's perhaps possible.
Instrumental. I don't think it's instrumental. The instrument you can see it over there very good resolution. It's just interpreting it. Lessons of useful assumptions.
Okay.
I think what you're saying is the way this looks is a real exclusion from the wall and then an accumulation. There is a variation in density into the fluid right at the bottom, which is inherent above, and has nothing to do with that.
Right, but the extent of that looks very big.
The extent of that is set by the correlation limit of the material, which we hear you are approaching, there's only 5 miles, but it's
maybe reasonably big.
So let's have a look at the properties of the free interface before we apply what we find here to the wetting problem. So the free interface can be described, as it turns out, quite well with standard capillary wave theory. And I recall here two important length scales. So one is the thermal agitation length of the interface. So this means that temperature wants to feed in these agitations, but then surface tension says, okay, fluctuation is fine, but with moderation. And then the second length is the capillary length, which is basically a competition between surface tension and the confinement in a sort of a potential that the interface experiences. And in this case, it could be just, in this case, could be, say, gravity. And it is. So we have here this crossover length, which is a length in the horizontal direction that will eventually prevent the interface from becoming really rough. It's like a cutoff length for interfacial roughness laterally. And the excursions in the vertical direction of this interface about its average height squared as a function of the lateral coordinates x and y, thermally averaged, behave like a quantity which can be understood from simple equipartition considerations and stems from integral dq over q, roughly speaking, with a kt over gamma strength. And so this kt over gamma is reflected in the overall amplitude here. And then there's a logarithm coming out of this integration. And the logarithm features various quantities that pertain to length scales. So there is the colloidal radius in here, there's the capillary length cutoff in here, and here there's the system size laterally, Lx, which is assumed to be much, much larger than the capillary length and becomes, strictly speaking, infinite in the thermodynamic limit. And again, there's a capillary length here. Now, without gravity, the capillary length goes to infinity, and there's no such damping of fluctuations going on, and so the interfacial height fluctuations will diverge if you consider them over a longer and longer parallel length scale. And in three dimensions here, the divergence is logarithmic, so rather weak. And it can be contrasted with its behavior in lower dimensions for thermal agitation-driven systems. And there we find that this height deviation squared, averaged, goes as the parallel length scale of the system to the power 2 zeta, where zeta is the roughness exponent, which is 3 minus d over 2 for thermal fluctuations. And so we are here in a kind of marginal regime where this divergence, which is normally power law, turns into a subtle logarithmic divergence in three dimensions. Then I already commented on the timescales for the fluctuations of the interface. So the timescales are much, much longer timescales for equilibration of capillary wave fluctuations. And this is due to the fact, basically, that the surface tension here is in the denominator. So that's a factor of a million reduction in the denominator. And there's a factor of 1,000 reduction in the numerator. So that still gives us, with a viscosity that's not all too different from molecular fluids, a factor of 10 larger, perhaps, will give us a quantity which is about 10,000 times larger than for molecular fluids, roughly speaking, or 100,000 times larger. Now, let's try to take some of these ingredients now back to our problem where the interface was unbinding from a vertical wall. So certain length scales are going to undergo a little bit of a rotation here, so to speak. And I've tried to draw the situation in terms of three lengths. So there is the wetting layer thickness, L. There is the roughness or width of the interface, which is the standard deviation of the height excursions, about average height. Height is here actually distance to with respect to the vertical wall. And there is the correlation length parallel to the interface, but here it's not the capillary length, because as you notice, gravity is in the orthogonal direction here. It's not the capillary length, but it's a length which pertains to correlations parallel to the interface, which, for example, for fluctuating interfaces, can get lost when the interface bumps into the wall. And so for strongly fluctuating interfaces, this parallel correlation length is rather easily interpreted as the average distance laterally between collisions of the interface with the wall. Now here in this system, we will see that fluctuations are more subtle than these bumping into the wall pictures would otherwise give you. But nevertheless, there is this parallel correlation length here that is featured, and that somehow feels that the interface is bound to the wall and therefore is not diverging yet.
So everything you use is kind of like a continuum theory of the fluid to describe, you know, for example, surface tension and the length scales that pertain to fluctuations in the interface, for example. So if the size of your molecule, in this case is a colloid, and you know, for example, the LT is of the same order as the size of the colloid, don't you have to worry about, you know, changes in the surface tension at those scales? So you have to modify the Tolman length and things like that. So is that okay?
So the idea here is that you look at, you look at the system in a situation where you are close to the unbinding transition. So you are looking at phenomena described by, in this case, diverging length scales compared to other length scales like bulk correlation length, which remains of the order of the colloidal size, and the colloidal size itself, of course. So here, although we're not near the bulk critical point in any sense, we deliberately want to stay away from the bulk critical points. We are in a situation which is called like complete wetting, or approach to complete wetting, which is in itself a phenomenon characterized by diverging lengths. And so you really go into the continuum description there automatically, close enough to the so-called complete wetting transition. Now, in reality, the thicknesses of these layers are observed to be of the order of like a couple of microns, which is, of course, not astronomical, and but still about 100 times larger than the colloidal size. So that would be in favor of a continuum description.
Still a partial wetting situation.
This is a situation which is called complete wetting, but slightly off of coexistence. But it's in the complete wetting regime, according to the best of their determinations of where we are in the wetting phase diagram.
Above the wetting temperature.
So in this case, temperature doesn't play a role, but if you play with concentrations, then it's in the regime where you have complete wetting. And the reason you don't see a macroscopic layer is that you have basically this bulk field, so to speak, that still keeps the wetting layer finite.
So the vertical axis in the
Okay, we're going to come to this. So first of all, I would like to say that what we pick up from the previous description of the free interface is basically that the fluctuation of the interfacial position about its average value squared and averaged is going to behave like this logarithm, where there are these two length scales in here, which is the lower cutoff and the higher cutoff. So the capillary length is effectively replaced by the parallel correlation length here. And the lower cutoff is in size is RC, the colloidal diameter. Then, given this particular piece of information, we're going to have a relationship already between the perpendicular correlation length, which is actually defined as the width of that interface. So the left-hand side is the perpendicular correlation length squared, and the right-hand side contains the parallel correlation length. So that is a capillary wave theory result, which is also part of the description, of 3D wetting theory with short-range forces. There is a wetting parameter, which is a dimensionless quantity here, which is kT over basically surface tension times bulk correlation length squared, a quantity which approaches a universal value close to the bulk critical point of the system, a value which is believed to be about 0.8 for the easing model in three dimensions. And then there is some references here to crucial papers that we have been either using or that we compare with for RG theory, renormalization group theory for wetting, and also for simulations and also experimental realizations of systems of this type in the form of binary polymer systems, binary polymer mixtures in this last case here. Then this theory predicts that the wetting layer thickness scaled by the bulk correlation length varies logarithmically with the parallel correlation length divided by the bulk correlation length, with an amplitude which is an algebraic function of this parameter omega, which is explicitly known. And I should say that there are different regimes, but we are in a regime which is the weakest fluctuation regime for this complete wetting context, which is omega less than 2. And since it's about 0.8, that's consistent. Combining this dependence of the wetting layer thickness on xi parallel with the dependence of xi perpendicular on xi parallel, we arrive at a relationship which has been derived before, at least once explicitly by Kerele, Klein, and Binder, in particular in this Europhysics Journal B paper. And combining these formulas for RG theory, we arrived at an expression here which, and I'm not saying that this is very important or not, but I'm just telling you that the expression that we derived differs by a factor of square root of pi divided by 2 from the expression that was derived here. And this just to say that this is not by any means a unique standard result that you can just plug from the literature. But it's very simply obtained by combining other things which are in the literature. So there is still a fine-tuning to be done in terms of definitions, whether or not the height squared averaged is exactly equal to the perpendicular correlation length squared, or whether there is a numerical factor still there to be taken into account. But it's presently under concern, and I don't have the answer yet to that. Something I want to figure out here, actually. So then this relationship tells you that the thermal length multiplied by the wetting layer thickness is proportional by a universal function of the wetting parameter, so it's actually non-universal, is proportional to the perpendicular correlation length squared. Now, the experimental fit to the data of the width of the interface determined in this way here, this convolution formula, versus the wetting layer thickness gives us, for one of the systems in our phase diagram, namely that closest to the bulk critical point, if you remember the dilution line that I talked about, so the system closest to the critical point displays this kind of dependence. Whereas the other systems much farther, or just farther from the critical point, say, display an almost constant width as a function of wetting layer thickness. Now, how is the wetting layer thickness varied? This is just by going at different heights, checking at different heights. So that's the way it's done here in this problem. So that's perhaps a bit naive, but this is how these data are obtained. And you can see that the square root behavior is fairly satisfactory here. So there is a nice consistency with the square root. And that's, I would say, I would like to stress, is remarkable. We'll see in a moment that physical intuition would almost never come up with the square root dependence, but either with a linear dependence or with just constant width. But that's for my conclusion. The theoretical estimate is the following one, which is just plugging in the results for surface tension, measured surface tension in the thermal length here, measured wetting layer thickness here in L, and the omega taken, borrowed from the easing model estimate here. So that gives you this expression, which fortuitously or not, is in good agreement with the theoretical prediction. If you use the formula of Carrier, Klein, and Binder, then the theoretical curve, which is depicted here, which is in this case that I described, is lower than the data, then that theoretical curve would be somewhat higher than the data, but the agreement would be almost equally good, but on the other side, it would be slightly larger than this 0.29 number. Now, how robust are these numbers? If you take omega to zero, you can take that amplitude down to zero. And if you vary it by sort of like a reasonable margin by a factor of two, say, if you vary it by a factor of two in either direction to 1.6 or to 0.4, you're still below two in each case, then this will differ by something like a 25%. So this is a reasonably robust estimate, but by no means very precise.
Could you enter a strong fluctuation of genes?
Omega greater than 2?
Yeah.
I wouldn't know at all how to vary omega here, actually. Because these phenomena only manifest themselves rather close to the phase boundary, mm-hmm. which means also rather close to the critical point. And then you are in this, then you're converging to that universal value.
25%?
Now, I should stress that there is no self-consistent check here yet on this quantity, because we don't know precisely enough the bulk correlation length here. So this is just assumed to be the easing model value for the moment.
I'm understanding this is for one particular polymer concentration.
And so this is.
So what's happening?
Let me go back a little bit to the phase diagram.
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me, it's too far. Here. So this is for the system which is this
right.
this particular concentration, if you like, which separates into two phases which are on a tie line which is inclined. And so one is about here, the other is about there.
So if you did it at
And at S2 and S1, the data are also displayed in this graph.
Sorry, that's what these different colors are?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and there no significant variation is seen.
It's robust in that sense.
I didn't speak about that robustness.
No, but I'm asking you this.
Yeah.
The blue guys are a little bit off from the red guys, but yeah, it's qualitatively similar.
Yes, so here, this
I don't know, it's a big difference, small difference.
This, say, how would you call them, these particular interface fluctuations that are reminiscent of wetting, of an unbinding phenomenon, they are not displayed here in this case. And the reason for that, we believe, is that if you estimate the magnitude of the potential that governs the unbinding, it's very, very, very much reduced if you go farther and farther from the critical point, from the bulk critical point. And so basically, the bulk correlation length plays a role in there that is important. And or in other words, the direct manifestation of the important fluctuations is due to the ultra-low interfacial tension. Which is due to two effects. One is the overall scales, and the other is the vicinity to the bulk critical point. So
time is now past 12, so maybe okay. We can break and you can talk about the contact line during lunch discussion.
Sure. May I just conclude with this remark? So why is Xi per proportional to square root of L very, very unusual? Well, if you have been calculating RG theory in 3D for short-range forces for 15 years, then you see nothing else but that. But that doesn't help other people who would say this is very, very queer. This is unusual. Why? Because there are two normal sorts of behavior, and that is a smooth interfacial, smooth interfacial properties, which are occurring in many systems where van der Waals forces dominate and in mean field theories and all that sort, plus possibly logarithmic corrections on that, like xi per proportional to log xi parallel, or log L, say log L, I should say. But that's still very, very weakly fluctuating. And the other system that's very, very well known is what's called fluctuation regimes. And this includes all fluctuation regimes for wetting. And it includes also membrane physics, where the fluctuations are such that the perpendicular correlation length is of the order of the wetting layer thickness. And then the interface regularly bumps into the wall and veers up again and so on. And so this is xi per proportional to L. That's the other behavior that you would expect for fluctuating interfaces. So regardless of short or long range forces, critical or complete wetting, and including membranes, for D less than the upper critical dimension of the problem. But now we are at the critical dimension. And so we have this very special behavior, which is something else, and it turns out to be power 1/2. Might have been power 1/3, or maybe 2/3, or God knows what, but it's not 1 and it's not 0. And so this is this peculiar world that we're actually we believe we are in this system, because we've checked the square root square root dependence, and it comes out rather neatly, even though it's only in one particular mixture that it is seen. So there's certainly room for a lot more checks. I would like to leave it to this, because you see, the line tension problem I can discuss with anyone particularly interested. It's really a separate sort of appendix thing. Thank you very much. Okay.